Hello and welcome to The Virtuous Life. I'm your host, Pat Odie Murray. And if you remember, last week we kind of started into this journey about talking about beauty, right? And I know some people might say, well, beauty, what's the point, right? But I tried to lay out last week's show the idea of truth, beauty, and goodness, right? That these are three characteristics of the divine, or that even draw us to the divine. So I want to use a quote from the book I was using last week to kind of get us focused, and then I'll introduce our guest for today. But it's talking about beauty, right? And this is that Awakening Wonder book that I referred to last week by Stephen Turley. He makes the point here that the important point here is that beauty, because of its divine nature, is always linked with the true and the good. In order for something to be truly beautiful, it must, by definition, draw one to the true and the good. So notice what Turley's saying here. The idea is that these are so intricately linked that you really don't talk about one without the other two. And notice what it says. It must, by definition, draw one to the true and the good. Well, what's the true and the good? God. Okay. So when we talk about beauty, beauty draws us to God. Okay. So let's kind of keep that in mind. And that, as I start the show out with that, I have a guest today. You may recognize his voice. He was on once before with me. I could be very formal and say it's Professor Jim Murray from Lourdes University, the music department. He's got his degree in music and his master's in education, and so he puts those together, and he is a music professor at Lourdes. But he's also my husband. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Pat. Good to be here. I just got out of Lourdes teaching my film class. I'm going to have to kind of mentally transition from movies into music. And the topic today is a pretty deep one, so we'll see what we can make out of it.
Yeah, and I think even what, you know, you and I kind of have these conversations all the time around the house, but I think even, you know, even though this isn't a show about film, certainly anything that we talk about, right, that is a work of art. And film is considered a work of art.
Yep.
Music. Next week we're going to be talking to an author of The Way of Beauty, who is an artist, a painter. So all of these works of art were always considered to draw us to the true and the good. And that was kind of the objective reality of things. And we certainly talk about that a lot with film, that nowadays it's really difficult to find a film lead you to the true and the good.
Well, we don't want to start out on a depressing note. So, but you're right. All of beauty in art, in an aesthetic sense, is built on that journey. I guess you might say a journey towards something bigger,
right?
Which would be God. Each art, I think, as you'll talk to different people, each art approaches what beauty is in that specific art historically a little bit different. So, you know, we'll talk about music today.
Right.
And you'll see that it won't be quite the same as I assume that an artist, a painter would describe beauty, or a filmmaker would describe beauty. But
yet they would use some of the common concepts.
I think so, yeah. I mean, the ultimate concept.
Right.
Which is the improvement of the person in some way,
right?
I think is a good place to start.
And Jim pulled up this article by Robert Riley, The Music of the Spheres. And Riley makes a good point here, I think, and he certainly shows it through music. And you're going to be sharing examples of this music with us and talking about this progression. But Riley really ties it very much to this kind of idea of our shared concept of reality. And he says that music in the Western world was shaped by a shared conception of reality so profound that it endured for some 2,500 years. And so what, and I, on this show, obviously with virtue and talking about the true and the good, the reason I wanted to talk about beauty was because so often I think, and again, we're the same age, so the idea is we kind of came through a lot of this when things were very subjective, that there wasn't, you might have been grounded in the objective, especially with music, in order to be a, you know, a theorist and to be able to write and compose. But so much of what I came through anyway as art and beauty at that time period, was very subjective, and it was really kind of confusing to me. So when I started to study this more and more, you start to see how the moral fiber, this idea of truth, what is good, and what is beautiful has changed and why it has changed. And so that's one of the things that we're certainly kind of digging into. And I think Riley, when he says, you know, we had this shared concept of reality for 2,500 years. And so that is what beauty and truth and goodness was based on.
I think that, I think you make a good point. I don't think there's anyone our age, and I won't say how old we are.
But, oh, that's all right. You know I'm
I don't
old.
Think there's anyone our age who has ever been exposed to the original concept of beauty.
Yes.
It's so foreign.
It is.
To our society that it really never even enters into anyone's heads anymore.
Right.
And that's why when we get into this, we'll sort of see how unusual it is in a sense. The thing also is, even though we may not be aware of it culturally, it does resonate with people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people know inherently when something is beautiful,
mm-hmm.
even if they can't quantify it, even if they can't say why this is beautiful because A, B, and C.
Right.
There is still imprinted on our hearts.
Ah, the natural law.
A basic filter, I guess you could
right.
say. This is beautiful. This is not. And I think.
Yeah, we're created in the image of God.
Exactly.
So that
and
should
I think
resonate
that's
with
still
us.
There. As much as we try to wring that mop out.
Yeah.
You know, we wring the mop of that natural law into the bucket
uh-huh.
and try to throw that water away.
Uh-huh.
You know, we never get rid of it totally because
yeah.
it's there.
And it is, as we always talk about on the show, it is, distorted at times because of sin, because of pride, because of all these things, and certainly, the author that I'm going to be talking with next week is going to spend some time with that. So I'm going to get to music and I want to talk about I want you to talk about, not me, but because Pythagoras, who is known for math, I mean, that's anybody that's a mathematician knows Pythagoras. But yet when you study beauty, he is at the heart of understanding beauty.
Well,
so
you know,
talk about that.
I always say that in theory, we all know Pythagoras.
Very that's funny. It's the Pythagorean theory.
That's my joke for the day.
There it is.
but this gets to the very heart of the idea, and you're right. Pythagoras is the philosopher, mathematician, much more philosopher almost,
yeah.
that comes up with this theory of beauty, that everything in the created universe is mathematical at its base.
Mm-hmm.
There are relationships between things that can be put in mathematical ratios. And he applies that to music, which is very easy to see. If you take a piece of string, a certain length, and pluck it, you will get a note.
Mm-hmm.
If you take that same piece of string, but only half of the length, and you pluck it, you will get the same note an octave higher.
Right.
There's a mathematical relationship. Same thing with the interval of a fifth. If you take a 3-foot piece of string, pluck it to get the note, then take a 2-foot piece of string, pluck it, you'll get a note that is a fifth higher than the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Pythagoras then discovers that if you go with the ratio of a 4-foot piece of string, pluck it, go to a 3-foot piece of string and pluck it, you get an interval of a fourth. So he discovered that all music, all musical tones, all vibrations are mathematical in their relationship. A 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 foot or four numerical relationship. Where this enters into beauty is that Pythagoras then extends this and asks the question, does this reoccur anywhere else in nature? You know, can all of the created world be seen as a series of interlocking mathematical relationships? This gets pretty deep.
Right.
He says it can be.
It can be, yeah.
And so for Pythagoras, beautiful music is music whose ratios, whose vibrations, whose tones are correctly in proportion, just as in nature, just as nature is incorrectly in proportion.
Mm-hmm.
So what is beautiful in music to the ancient Greeks is what is corresponding to the natural world.
Right.
The created world, God's creation. Sound, if you talk to if you would talk to Pythagoras or Socrates or Plato, they would all say that sound music is nothing more than the physical manifestation of the whole plan of creation. That's what makes something beautiful. If you vibrate your strings in a manner that is not in those rational proportions,
right,
you get what they would call ugly music.
Disharmony.
Disharmony, dissonance, not consonants.
So the idea, because in this article, he talks about, and the whole heaven to be made to be a musical scale and a number. So
yes.
So what does he mean by that? That the whole of heaven and the
Well, Pythagoras, now we don't have anything that Pythagoras wrote. Nothing survived.
Okay.
But his students taught the next generation, blah, 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 on down. So we know what the theory was. Pythagoras extended this to the entire universe. He said that the universe functions as if there's a string at the center of the earth, and the string extends not 3 feet or 4 feet, but to the end of the universe. And he posits that the positioning of the planets in relation to the earth, the sun, the moon, all of creation is at the correct intervals on that theoretical piece of string.
Mm-hmm.
This is where they come up with what eventually gets to be called the music of the spheres.
Okay.
This theory that, and it was commonly accepted all the way through the Middle Ages.
Okay.
This theory, the music of the spheres idea, that the entire universe hums with these proportional vibrations.
Okay.
When things are right, it hums along in beautiful ratio. Human beings can't hear it. I think Augustine wrote that upon your deathbed, the last thing you hear is the actual music of the heavens.
The music of the heavens.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so that's what we mean when you hear that term, the music of the spheres. This idea that all of nature is in harmony, and that's what they would use the word harmony.
Harmony for.
We talk about like a G major chord, harmony.
Right.
That's not harmony to these guys.
Mm-hmm.
Harmony is, are you in accord with those universal vibrations? And they felt it was very simple to see a person who wasn't. They were unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
They were sad. They were destructive.
Right.
You know, they were out of harmony.
Right. And I think, again, Riley in this piece certainly talks about that idea that, he says, Plato taught that rhythm and harmony find their way into the inward places of the soul on which they mightily fasten, imparting grace and making the soul of him who is rightly educated graceful. And when I listened to that, I thought, you know, because he goes on to say, you know, the ancient Greeks were so aware of the power of music that they understood certain music helped people to live harmonious lives. And in the same way, then, they understood that musical discord could distort the spirit. I find that fascinating for today when we look at what's going on musically today, right? And I think that's kind of what you mean by, and maybe I'm wrong, but that's what you mean by the idea that it's almost interior to us. We recognize it. And,
yeah.
And so like if I'm, you know, even if I'm playing music at the piano, you know, I hit a wrong note. Ooh, I just cringe.
There for a moment, you're out of harmony with the universe.
And out of harmony with the composer and yeah. everything else. But yeah, so it's like, and you can do that. Like if you go to a band concert or something and some instrument squeaks or does something it's not supposed to. It to me, I always think of it as like fingernails on a blackboard. It just, ooh, you go, ooh, that wasn't supposed to be.
Well, your analogy is interesting because that's what separates music from noise.
Yeah.
Noise is just random vibrations out of sync with what we'll refer to as the music of the spheres. That's
mm-hmm.
noise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why isn't pounding on a table music?
Mm-hmm.
Well, as we'll find out later in the 20th century.
Some say it is.
Some say it is. But we'll get into that later.
And I love before we get into, because I know you have a clip that we're going to play here that you're going to lead into. But before we get there, I really love the line that he talks about, music was seen more as a discovery than a creation.
Yes.
Because it relied on pre-existing principles of order in nature for its operation. That's just yes. how we talk about truth and goodness today
right.
in moral theology. You know,
right.
is I'm not creating the laws. They're there, and it's my role to discover them. So it's really interesting to hear that in regards to beauty, which, of
right.
course, is music.
Yes. I mean, and that's a great point. This idea of discovery, you know, in a very weird sense, all music exists. We discover it. We take those harmonious bits and pieces and put them together in a way that creates further or enhanced harmony.
Right.
We don't take just random things. These things, these vibrations. This music of the spheres, if you want to keep calling it that.
I always thought that was a piece of music I should be looking for. Music of the spheres.
No. I don't know. That went right past my head. I don't know where you're going.
Every time you say music of the spheres, I think I'm supposed to Google that and I'll find a piece of music called music of the spheres.
No, you won't.
Okay. I just want to point
out
to somebody the audience.
Somebody may have used that title.
That's true.
But
they might have. That's not what we're talking about.
But it's funny. You talked about music's power over the individual. This was held to be the case for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. there was a guy, a musical teacher called Damon of Athens, and he famously said that he would rather control the music in a city than in laws,
uh-huh.
because the music has a more decisive effect on the formation of the character of the citizens.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. I mean,
wow.
And this was always thought to be the case.
Yeah.
Shakespeare writes, you know, in several of his plays, he has characters speak
mm-hmm.
of this harmony, of this universal idea of harmony and not discord.
Well, why don't you kind of lead us into that first example of music
well, sure.
that you're going to share with us.
What we're going to hear here is a bit of Gregorian chant. Now, this is a very good representation of the philosophies we've been talking about. The idea that music should be in consonance with God. The purpose of music is to draw us, get us vibrating, if you will, mm-hmm. in that
harmonious
same,
nature.
Very good. So when we listen to this Agnus Dei, this Gregorian chant, you can hear how it's very simple and consonant, and how its purpose is not to entertain. Its purpose is to draw us into that universal vibration at Universal Creation.
On news day, qui tollis peccata mundi, miserere nobis. On news day, qui tollis peccata mundi, miserere.
Well, there you go. So you see the point of the relationship between the notes, the intervals used are all consonant. In fact, in Gregorian chant at that time, there were intervals you were not allowed to use. They were so discordant. Uh-huh. They were so out of touch with the vibrations.
Can you give an example?
Oh, yeah, the tritone. If you sit at a piano and you play the note F, and then you jump and play the note, go up to B natural.
Okay.
That's known as a tritone. In the medieval period, it was known as the devil's interval.
Really?
Because it was so discordant that you were not allowed to use it.
So when you say discordant with that F to B natural, meaning that kind of isn't a natural, we would naturally make that in our when we sing. Right?
No, well, yeah, basically.
Kind of.
The transition of vibrations between those two notes is not found in nature.
Oh, okay.
You can't find anything, a tree or according to the music
this
of the sphere.
Ratio.
The ratios.
Okay.
The vibrations.
Oh, interesting.
You know, it's not 1 to 2. It's not two to three. It's like, and I don't know exactly what it is, but it'd be like 1 to 7.2.
Okay.
Something weird.
Okay.
Yeah, it just doesn't.
Now I'm going to go home and sit at the piano and do that so I can hear it because I'm trying to
think
of it in my head.
It's the devil's interval.
Uh-oh, I got to be careful. Okay, yeah. So I'm not going to play it a lot. So where do we go from here then in this appreciation for what music does for us and the human spirit in a sense, beauty?
Well, at this point, with Gregorian chant here in the year 800 or so, there's no argument anywhere in Western civilization about these theories.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not a point of discussion. Everyone knows this.
Mm-hmm.
Boethius, who was a Roman writer, Roman philosopher, around the year 500, writes the music theory book and puts all these theories down, again, reiterating what the ancient Greeks taught. And that book is still used at Oxford University in 1850.
Yeah.
I mean,
for over
1,000 years, it was just the accepted idea of what beauty was in music and how you achieve it.
So it was called The Principles of Music, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's a long Latin name.
Are you familiar with, I mean, have you seen?
Oh, sure.
You didn't use that book in your
education. No.
Education.
It's far too philosophically based. It's a heavy slog, as they say. But that's what it does.
It lays down those principles.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we run all the way through until we get to the Renaissance when music begins to leave the church and enter secular society and becomes used for entertainment purposes.
Okay.
We begin to drift away from the goal being harmonizing with the natural law.
Mm-hmm.
The goal starts to slightly shift, like the hands of a clock going from 12 to 1. It starts to slightly shift into how can I be entertaining with this? How can I express my personal emotions with this?
And what year did you say, around what time?
I'm going to say 1,200.
1,200.
1,100, okay. 1,200. I mean, that's okay. pretty general, but okay. yeah, okay. around there.
So it starts to shift. And is there any composer or a writer that is known during that time for kind of making that shift happen, or is it just a
it's a gradual thing. Monteverdi, who is going to be at the end of the Renaissance, beginning of the Baroque period, mm-hmm. he's going to do this. In the Renaissance, we're going to see the beginning of something they call word painting, where if in the words of your song, you try to reflect with music a specific word.
Okay.
So if the word, for example, is I looked up in the sky, mm-hmm. when you're writing your notes, when you get to the word sky, you go up.
Up. It should be the highest point.
Exactly.
Right.
If you go, if the word is valley, you'd make the notes go down.
Okay.
Just these little subtle things. Now we're taking music into a different philosophy.
Right. Okay. So now we're kind of looking as we get to this time period, the Renaissance, now we're looking more at it's not this being in harmony with the natural order, but it's more just opening up more ideas and understanding of what music is.
Right. Composers begin expressing themselves.
Okay.
Instead of trying to get in sync with the universe.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I for some reason, I thought that occurred later. So that's an interesting. I mean, I knew that
it begins that, then.
Okay, yeah, because I knew, like, you know, the madrigals and all those things. You know, start to music
yes,
starts
yeah.
moving out into this entertainment
right. I mean,
realm. I didn't really think about what that did to music, though.
Well, you know, I mean, much like your garden, you know, you plant the seed. Here in the Renaissance, we're getting the little sprout.
Got it. Okay.
Later, it's going to turn into a giant corn stalk.
We'll
get to that later.
So we're heading into break. Jim, what are we going to be looking at when we come back from break? What are we going to jump into audience?
I just want to quickly jump to the Council of Trent.
Okay.
Which kind of – where the church finally addresses this idea that, you know, music's out of control.
Okay.
And then –
boy, back at the Council of Trent, we thought music was out of control.
Oh, yeah. Oh my goodness.
Well, there's your teaser. I hope you'll come back on the other side as we're talking about beauty in regards to music today. What is beautiful music? Because obviously beauty is a part of living the virtuous life. So that's what you're listening to, The Virtuous Life. Our guest today is Mr. Jim Murray, professor at Lourdes University in the music department. So come back on the other side of the break.
Ignite Radio Live, Tuesday nights, 8 p.m.
God is alive and moving. His real presence is transforming real lives.
We are Greg and Stephanie Schleter.
We're parents of six and so excited to be united with all of you in this place at this time.
Ignite Radio Live, Tuesday nights, 8 p.m.
We invite you to be more than a spectator, but a participant.
Get on board right now at massimpact.us. Not just a moment, a movement.
Lang Electric has underwritten a portion of this program today. Lang Electric is a licensed, bonded, and insured electrical contractor and handles residential, farm, commercial, and industrial applications, and more. They are members of the Better Business Bureau and the Toledo Metropolitan Electrical Contractors Association. Please visit their website, langelectric.com, or you may reach them at 419-478-7733.
This is Ron Miller. Join me and Bishop Thomas at the Bishop's Corner on Annunciation Radio.
Hello and welcome back to The Virtuous Life. I'm your host, Pat Odie Murray. And we're doing a little series here of three shows on beauty and in regards, obviously, to truth and goodness. But what role does beauty play in the virtuous life? And last week, we laid out kind of some grounding using just a few pages from the text Awakening Wonder by Stephen Turley. And today, we have a guest host. Of course, maybe
guess,
he could be
yeah.
a guest host. Mr. Professor Jim Murray from Lourdes University. He teaches in the music department there. And in full disclosure, he is also my husband. So if I happen to say honey during the interview, I'm not dissing on my husband.
Not being overly familiar.
That's right. I'm not being overly familiar. He is my husband. So welcome back, hon.
No problem, baby.
So anyway, we're laying out and we've got up to the Council of Trent. We're talking about music and what music really is. And so we've got to the Council of Trent. Now, we had just started to kind of plant the seed, as you said, of kind of a personal personal interpretation of music.
A personal expression.
Expression of music.
Music becoming, an egotistical word would probably be too strong, but music that whose purpose is to express what the composer wants to express.
Okay, great. So take us to Trent.
Well, by the time the Council of Trent, 1545, I think, somewhere around in there,
mm-hmm.
By the time that rolls around, one of the problems that the church feels is that music is far too personal.
Okay.
We've gotten away from the whole idea of music to get in concert and in concord with the universe, with mm-hmm. the natural creation.
Mm-hmm.
And we're way too far over to, I want to write something that talks about what I think about God or, mm-hmm. or so, such and so.
Okay.
One of my favorite quotes here is from one of the bishops who was at the Council of Trent, who wrote this. He wrote, "In our times, the composers have put all of their industry and effort into writing imitative passages, so that while one voice sings Sanctus, another sings Sabbath, still another sings Gloria Tua with howling, bellowing, and stammering, so that they more nearly resemble cats in January than flowers in May."
Really? One of the bishops at Trent said that?
Oh, yeah. I love that guy.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, obviously he didn't have a high opinion of the music at that time.
No,
yeah.
The music basically they felt was getting far too complicated.
Okay.
And if you recall the Gregorian chant we played earlier is certainly not a complicated piece of music.
Mm-hmm.
But so the Council of Trent passes some suggestions that churches should do. Most of which, this is what they declare in 1562. In the cases of those masses which are celebrated with singing and with organ, let nothing profane be intermingled, that'd be the texts,
mm-hmm.
but only hymns and divine praises. No personal expressive music.
Okay.
The whole plan of singing in musical mode should be constituted not to give empty pleasure to the ear, but in such a way that the words should be clearly understood by all, and thus the hearts of the listeners be drawn to desire of heavenly harmonies in the contemplation of the joys of the blessed.
Mm-hmm.
To translate what we talked about earlier, music should get us into harmony with the universe, into harmony with God.
And in liturgy, it's harmony with God, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, again, this is what they were after at the Council of Trent. Their solution, at the time, let me put it this way. At the time, a lot of composers said, well, we're past that.
Right.
You can't write beautiful music that is clear and accomplishes those things.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't do it.
Right.
So it took a guy by the name of Palestrina mm-hmm. to prove them wrong. And that's why Palestrina is so celebrated in church music, is he did that. He wrote music that followed the vibrational consonances that mm-hmm. were established and yet was also beautiful to listen to. It did elevate people in the right way.
Okay. And we have a clip of that, don't we?
Yes, we do. We have a clip of Palestrina. This would have been around 1604 he wrote this. This is Sicut Caravus, which I think translates, if I remember my Latin, to the lamb. No, the deer. Oh, the deer will – the running deer towards water.
Water, yeah.
You
okay.
know, trying
my
to –
My soul, like the –
exactly.
yeah, the deer toward running water.
So here's yep. Palestrina.
Okay. That is beautiful.
You know, I always tell people that I hope at the moment that I pass off of this earth, I hope that that's what greets me.
Yeah.
Because
that's gorgeous.
That is gorgeous.
Yeah.
And Pythagoras, if he could come up out of the ground, he would say, that is beautiful.
Right.
Because that's that harmonic ratio
that he talks about.
That is in sync with the universe.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, Palestrina becomes, the important guy at this time in church music. But music doesn't kind of come back fully to this understanding of objective beauty, that it's not just me and what I think is pretty, but there are objective rules, objective things that we follow, right? I mean, there's still, even though Palestrina is doing this, there's still this music that continues to go down the path of personal expression.
As wonderful as Palestrina was, and Palestrina, it is important because you can trace a thread of that philosophy from then even up till now. Mm-hmm. There are still composers each year from 1600 to now who carry on that philosophy and try to do that.
Right.
It never goes away totally.
Right. But it's not as prevalent as what it was.
But it doesn't win the day
right.
with society, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
And the next example I want to play for everyone is an example of where music goes. And where it goes, maybe, I guess, the opposite side of Palestrina. This is a piece by a composer named Carlo Gesualdo, a very famous piece that everybody studies when they go to music school because this is an example of personal expression in music.
Okay.
I gotta be honest, when I was at Bowling Green, I shouldn't have mentioned where it was, but this piece was held up as a good thing.
Right.
It was proper for music to get away from
the rules
and into this personal expression. Now, Gesualdo, this would be about 1611. This is a piece called Moro Lasso. And even the title, which if my Italian is right, is something along the lines of, I die and then I grieve. So it's about me.
Right, right.
You see?
Yeah, exactly. Personal expression.
Palestrina, he's writing using text directly out of a psalm.
Right.
Gesualdo's writing about, I am not happy because the love of my life has left me.
Okay.
So you'll hear the extreme disharmony in this piece.
Okay.
So just kind of keep Palestrina in the back of your head and listen to this.
Okay.
Oh.
That's really interesting.
Yes, it is. You know, I find it interesting that Gesualdo wasn't so, I don't want to say radical, but he wasn't so different.
He wasn't.
I mean, he felt like he had to end on a consonant, a good set of vibrations.
Yeah, exactly.
But he wasn't ready just to throw it all out.
Because you hear the harmony every so often within, but then you get these kind of like, you know, notes you're not expecting to hear because they're not what we would say they're not in harmony.
They're not in what the Greeks called harmony. They're the wrong vibrations.
Right.
But Gesualdo would tell you that that was what he's aiming at.
Right.
He was aiming at using that discordant music because that was expressed what he felt or what he wanted to communicate.
Okay. Well, and it's interesting because I like when you said, you know, when you were in school, which 70s, I mean, it was the 70s, you were in college.
Yes.
So, but I mean, that this was held up as this is kind of what was, it's kind of like people are telling you this is beautiful. I mean, it's almost like,
I had wonderful professors.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to impugn them in any way.
No.
But yes.
But that's, I mean, not just at Bowling Green. I'm sure this was what was happening all over in music. They're saying this is beautiful instead of when you listen to something, you know it's beautiful. Somebody has to tell me that discordance is beautiful because if I just listen to it, it really doesn't touch my soul in the same way. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what society does.
Right. It takes us away
in lots
from
of different ways.
Right. It takes us away from truth, beauty, and goodness. Okay. So, now, like you said, it almost seems like Gesualdo was kind of struggling with this concept. He thought, you know, well, I'm gonna throw. I mean, it's in there, but he wouldn't totally give up.
No, I don't think he struggled at all. I mean, I think he did exactly what he wanted to do. It's just that my point was.
Okay, I'm giving him more.
Well, you're trying to give him more credit than to do. He was doing exactly what he wanted to do.
11,
but he felt he couldn't throw it all away.
Right.
So you're right. There are moments in there where hear very nice consonant bits and pieces, particularly if you just listen to the last 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
now, is this atonal music, Jim?
Oh gosh, no.
No. Okay, that's okay. What would you?
Oh, we'll get to that.
Okay. Well, what would you term this?
This is
just
simply
the introduction of discordance.
Yeah, this would be.
Okay.
You know, technically, if you're teaching this to a class, this would be the use of dissonance.
Okay.
For expressive purposes.
Okay.
Dissonance being. Disharmony.
Disharmony. Okay. Yeah. So he introduces this, and obviously, again, this continues down the path, right? So where do we kind of go next in this development of beauty and music?
Well, from 1600 on, personal expression wins the day.
Okay.
For the vast majority of people. You know, you have a composer like Bach, Johann Sebastian Bach, who clings very firmly to the notion that music, the whole purpose of music is to honor God and to become closer to God, a very Pythagorean way of thinking.
Right.
Bach being around 1700, 1750.
So he still hung on to that.
Oh, yeah. And like I said earlier, you can find those composers in a steady genealogy who still cling to that idea. But you get Beethoven. Then you get into the Romantics, whose only purpose is personal expression,
okay.
And we get up to the 20th century.
Well, and I must admit, I love this line in this article. John Adams, who is an American composer
today. Yeah, I like
today,
this one too.
This is a great quote that he said. John Adams, one of the most popular American composers today, said that he had, and this is in quotes, learned in college that tonality died somewhere around the time that Nietzsche's God died, and I believed it. The connection is quite compelling. At the same time God disappears, so does the intelligible order in creation. If there is no God, nature no longer serves as a reflection of its creator. And then it goes on to say, if you lose the logos of St. Clement, You lose the ratio of Pythagoras. Nature is stripped of its normative power. This is just as much a problem for music as it is for philosophy.
Yeah, that's a great quote. John Adams is one of those composers who is in that genealogy of trying to stay in a more I'll use the term Pythagorean idea.
Right. Okay.
But it's certainly true. You know, if there's no God, there's no order to creation. It's all random. If there's no order to creation, those ratios that Pythagoras was talking about were just random.
They're meaningless.
And they're meaningless. And so we don't need to follow them. In fact, to follow them, you're just putting an unnecessary harness on your creativity.
Right.
And this is where the 20th century goes with composers like Schoenberg.
Schoenberg, I must admit, I don't know these guys. I mean, you're the musician in the family. But when I read this article, I a couple times about how he describes things, I just wrote wow next to it. Like, I can't believe any musician would do this. I mean, it just seems so – what's his issue?
Well,
Arnold, Jim?
I don't think Arnold had any issues. He was just – taking things to its logical conclusion. Arnold Schoenberg steps on the slippery slope and slides right down to the bottom. You know, he
says if there are no Pythagorean ratios of no harmony, then let's go for it.
I have to say that he doesn't hit the bottom. There are people who go farther than he does. But when we start talking now about tonality, use that term.
Mm-hmm.
Tonality is the modern word for what the Greeks called harmony. Tonality is the system, the organizing system of vibration.
Got it.
Ratio. The organizing system of ratio.
Okay.
Schoenberg is the man who throws out tonality in the 1920s. He says that tonality doesn't exist in nature, so it's just an arbitrary construct of man. Mm-hmm. He's exactly opposite of what Pythagoras would have said.
Right.
Now, Schoenberg does believe that numbers exist in nature, and numbers could be the key to the universe. But where Pythagoras says we must reflect, we got to get in unison, we got to get in partnership with those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Schoenberg says, now that I know about the numbers, I can start to manipulate those numbers and create a new reality.
Okay. So that's what he does.
That's what he does. He basically throws out tonality in favor of atonality.
Okay.
There is no organizing principle. Schoenberg invents what we call the 12-tone system.
Okay.
There are 12 existing notes in creation.
Right.
But they're not organized. He says, you just randomly pick those 12 in any order, and you've got yourself a fine piece of music.
Okay.
In essence, Schoenberg is going to say that music now becomes a matter of technique, of personal manipulation of reality to create your reality, not a purposeful manipulation of reality to get closer
to the objective
reality. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
That's pretty deep.
Well, and I'm want to be really good on time here because we still have a couple pieces that we want to listen to. So
they're relatively short.
Okay. So
the next one is going to be the Suite for Piano by Schoenberg from 1923. And you will hear where we've gone from Gregorian chant.
Okay. realize I was such a good piano player in the third grade. Jeez, that sounds like my recital piece.
But how often have you heard people our age say, you know, anyone could make that.
Right.
What makes that art?
Right. There you go.
There you go.
And I really do want to get to the bottom of the slippery slope here, and we only have about 3 minutes left. Okay. So who is this?
Well, we're going to move now up to John Cage, who took Schoenberg one step farther and said that if where Schoenberg said the point of the point is disorientation,
right. Remove.
Cage basically says there is no point.
Got it.
And so this is a piece called Prelude for Meditation by John Cage.
Okay.
You know you're in trouble with music if somebody has to say, is that it?
Well, and you know, it said that Cage said that the aim of, well, he didn't say it, but it was a point of the aim of which was to emancipate people from the tyranny of meaning. Like, there should be no purpose for music.
Right.
No purpose for anything. Cage, and that song proved it.
Yeah, Cage is famous in musical history for indeterminacy, which means that the music's not even barely written down. You basically do anything you want. One of his most famous pieces is called 433. And 433 is where a performer comes out, sits in a chair on stage, and does nothing for 4 minutes and 33 seconds.
Uh-huh.
The music is whatever ambient noise, somebody coughing in the audience, somebody opening up a whatever. Yeah. That's the
piece
music. It changes at every performance.
Okay. Oh man, this is amazing. I mean, in an hour, we kind of took a quick trip here, through music, but it kind of does point to what I've been talking about with beauty is that we really, as Catholic Christians, believe so deeply that there is objective beauty and what we have done, just like we've talked about moral truths and moral goodness, just as we have tried to subjectify truth and goodness, we've also done that with beauty.
I mean, music is so emblematic of everything. When you remove God and you place man in the center, end up with Schoenberg and Cage.
Yeah.
You end up with, it's whatever I want it to be.
Whatever I want it to be. There doesn't have to be a purpose.
There does not have to be beauty. Beauty is not even a consideration anymore.
Well, thank you so much, honey, for being a part of this
show.
Well,
you know what? It's been a real pleasure. I'd like to send a shout out to my new godson, Evan. And hope he's feeling well and doing nicely down there in Ottawa, Ohio.
All right. And you have been listening to The Virtuous Life. I'm your host, Pat Odie Murray. Our guest today was Professor Jim Murray from Lourdes University, the music department. And I pray that you have a beautiful week ahead.